you're really looking for opportunities for people to buy pins and then trade them to create an experience. And the pin was there to help memorialize that experience. So when you held the pin up, you could say, yeah, I remember when I was there, I met this incredibly funny lady from Switzerland, and she had this unique pin from back when, from the Innsbruck Games, and I had this pin from Nagano, and I traded my pin with her. And so you have this incredible experience, and it's all because Coca-Cola was there creating that pin for you to be able to have that exchange. And it was magical. I mean, it was really magical what happened, and it's something I'm so glad I got to be part of.
Oh, such a good question.
Well, when you come with these questions, that's another great branding question.
That's a big question.
That's a very interesting question because it really makes you think about what you just did.
Welcome to the Your Living Brand.Life show. This show is all about how you communicate your value, how you build influence through trust, and recognizing who your audience is and who they are not. Through our weekly conversations with our guests, we will explore different ways to enable you to demonstrate your uniqueness while we ask them, what's your story? And now, welcome our host, Ben Baker.
And welcome back to another episode of the Your Living Brand.Live show. Thank you, my wonderful audience, for joining me yet for another week. I love that you guys share. I love the fact that you guys subscribe. Thank you all for everything that you do. This week, I have Pete Canalicchio. He's going to kill me if I said it wrong, but you know, I've been practicing. I just got a thumbs up. So I actually did it right. We're going to be talking about brand activation on an Olympic scale. So Pete, welcome to the show.
Ben, great to be here. I'm so excited to talk about this with you and to have some fun along the way.
We are going to have a blast. I mean, you and I always have a good time when we talk off air, but I want everybody to have a little bit of a history behind you because, you know, you're an ex-Navy guy. You're an ex-Navy pilot,
yeah.
You know, and you've got the Olympics, you got Coca-Cola, but I mean, there's a whole bunch of things we could talk about, but I'm going to let you tell a bit of the story. How did you get to the point now we're at Brand Alive?
It's been a fun ride. And literally, I was telling you off air that I've been renovating my basement. And in one room, I've got all my Navy memorabilia. And the other side, I've got all this Coca-Cola and other Olympic memorabilia. And it started out with my Navy career. I was on the West Coast down in San Francisco Bay Area and then ultimately instructed in Jacksonville, Florida, and then got my MBA and got hired at Chapel Hill, North Carolina, UNC, and got hired to the Coca-Cola company. And that was really the launching pin for everything that's happened since then. I started out in finance because I was good with math. But then after about 5 years, transitioned into marketing roles and learned about licensing and brand expansion and got to work on my Olympic programs, including everything from Nagano to Salt Lake to Athens to Vancouver and Sochi. And about, almost 12 years ago, March of this year will be 12 years, I had been working for the Newell Rubbermaid Company, running Rubbermaid's global licensing business, and then got promoted out of that to run a business called CardScan. And in 2009, I found myself with a lot of other folks on the outside looking in going, okay, what's next? And that actually looked like a curse at the time, was turned out to be one of the greatest blessings because then I could launch my own company and help others understand how to help their brands come alive in the hearts of those that experience them. And I've had a heck of a lot of fun working with folks over those years doing just that in small companies, big companies. I like to look for folks that are overcomers, that aren't afraid of an obstacle and want to find a way and don't get upset when things go difficult and accept no as a route to yes and success.
Well, it's fun because there's always a way over, under, through something. It's just a matter of figuring out what it is. And I love that mentality. I've got an attitude that I say that says, look, the glass isn't either half full or half empty. It's refillable. And I think you're one of me.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And that's my mindset. It's like, okay, and I tell this to my kids, four kids, two daughters that are in college. And I say, listen, if everything was easy, you would have nothing to talk about. So let's hope for those challenging times because they actually develop us and show us where our limits are and then give us a story later to talk about.
Oh, that's cool. So let's talk about, you know, there's the transition from the Navy to Coca-Cola. But from finance to marketing, that's the one that really makes most people's head shake, is to sit there going, how do you go from being in the finance department at Coca-Cola which is numbers, crunch, you know, button down, suit and tie, very rigid type mentality, to the creativity of branding. So I want to take that history, because I think that needs a little bit of exploring, because I think that'll probably launch us into your whole Coca-Cola career and talk about that brand activation, because that's really where we want to go.
Okay, I'm looking forward to sharing some with you. So when I was at business school, I did an emphasis in finance because I was good at math, and I actually studied physics as an undergrad. So I thought, well, this will be an easier route for me. Thankfully, at Chapel Hill, there was kind of a general management program. So while I had an emphasis in finance, I got exposed to these other subjects. So I get hired into Coca-Cola in their finance department, and I'm having fun. I'm working with the European group. So I'm in engaging with different nationalities, and I love that part of my flying days in the Navy. And I'm seeing all of these things that are going on in my amazing organization. And most of the people that are having fun are the marketers. And so
yes, they are.
I am missing out on something. And it's funny because the finance folks around me, a lot of them just didn't act like I did. I was more outgoing and gregarious and wanting to get involved in stuff. And so I was looking for a route to do that. And after a couple of years, I got invited to go into the Treasury Department, where I first managed Coca-Cola's long-term debt. We actually borrowed money for 100 years, issued those debentures in 1993, 100-year, $150 million worth of debentures. And then I did a commercial paper where I sold basically borrowed money at a very short time frame for about a year. And then I got into London and I worked on their international cash operations. And when that was over, there was a transition point that was really offered up to me. But I knew at Coke, you know, if you wanted to leave a function, that was really challenging because they expected you to go all the way up that function. And so I had a conversation with the treasurer of the company and I said, listen, I want to be a general manager. I think the best route for me to be a general manager is to get some cross-functional experience. Can I get your permission to look for opportunities in marketing? And unbeknownst to me, there was someone that was in his organization just a couple of years back who had moved into a kind of a more senior role, but overseeing the business affairs of how the company invested in sponsorship. And so I met that person. Her name was Melody Justice. We had a good conversation. She said, look, I need somebody from my team. Why don't you come join me? And so all of a sudden, I found myself negotiating sponsorship contracts for Major League Baseball, the National Hockey League, and the Olympic Games. And I was looking at the business side of these sponsorships, and it was really interesting to see how those were done. And of course, this was back in the middle 1990s, 1996, we were celebrating the Atlanta Olympic Games and doing that in a big way. And so I got involved in a thing called Coca-Cola Olympic City. Coca-Cola company spent about $30 million creating a theme park that lasted 100 days.
Wow.
Yeah, built it, it lived, and then it was gone. Totally gone. And through that, I met a woman named Lorianne Goldman. Lorianne was running worldwide licensing, and she called me up a couple months after the games were over and said, hey, I want you to come talk to me. And I'm like, okay. So I go over there, and she's like, I'm running worldwide licensing. I want to create a group called Event Merchandising, which is basically create merchandise to help memorialize our activation of the Olympics. And I want you to head that group. And I was like, it's got to do with the Olympics? I'm in. I don't know what the rest of it you're talking about, but I love the Olympics. I remember just being fascinated in front of my TV at a very young age. I mean, like watching every hour of every game till the wee hours of the night. And so for me, it was like, okay, let's do it. And it turned out it was this thing called, you know, event licensing or dual branded licensing or multi-branded licensing. And my first event was the Nagano Olympic Games. And so I'll pause there, but that's kind of how it came to be.
See, you would have been the ideal client for me. Back then, I was involved in custom branded promotional marketing, but at global scale, looking at the stuff at, let's take it all the way from the 3D printer to the manufacturing trips to China to be able to sit there and create something that was totally unique for particular customers. So I get where you're coming from. And there's not very many people out there that understand the intricacies of what you were trying to create, because the amount of vendors that you would have to manage to be able to make sure that the brand is consistent across a variety of different mediums, across different substrates, and be able to make sure everything is there on time and on budget. Because let's face it, when the Olympics are done, they're done. Nobody cares about Nagano stuff 6 months after Nagano. You know, there might be a couple collectors that you might be able to sell a few things to, but it's basically done.
Yeah, I always said, look, the Olympic Games are going to start whether we're ready or not, so we better be ready. I mean, there's nobody's going to wait for us. So it was always insanely crazy. And the truth of the matter is, most of these instances, I was starting way later than I wanted to. When I joined that group, it was in 1997, and the Games were a year off. Well, I mean, to do this thing right, I should have been starting in 1996 or even late 1995. So we were racing to the finish line, doing lots of things in parallel that should have been done in series, and just trying to get our merchandise there on time for the Games. And in some categories, we were a month ahead, and most of them, though, we were literally just like getting them done the week before the Games started. But, you know, the Nagano Games, we had merchandise all along the Olympic torch relay routes. I'll say routes because Japan had to do it differently. They actually had three torch relay routes going at the same time, which had never been done before. And we had merchandise along there. We had merchandise in and around the Nagano Prefecture. And then we had our core pin trading center, which was basically a retail store where we unveiled all of our Olympic pins, and including a pin of the day set that formed a puzzle piece, which ultimately formed the Coca-Cola bottle. So it was fun. I mean, it was chaos, and we didn't know whether we were going to sell any pins. And by the time it was done, there was nothing on the shelves. In fact, we had to have single-branded Coca-Cola non-Olympic pins shipped in from Atlanta just to fill the shelves, because it was so crazy how big the pin craze became, which was amazing to be part of. I mean, I still can't believe it to this day.
So let's break it down to the, I mean, there are so many different directions we can go here, but let's talk about pins, because for a pin collector, I was part of the 2010 Vancouver Olympic experience. I worked for the city of Richmond on the protocol team, and everybody had pins. Everybody had pins, and you had pins that you kept, you had pins that you traded, you had pins that you shared, but it was all about the experience of the conversation that went along with the pin. But how do you create that whole activation? Because we're not talking about one pin. We're talking about 500 pins, 1,000 pins, different pins for different days, different VIP pins that are bespoke and, you know, and only certain people get, and then there's certain pins that everybody can have. So how do you go about even thinking about where to start on a program like that? Because it's got to be monumental.
So you touched on a really good point, the idea around the experience. And truth be told, one of the greatest reasons why Coca-Cola is the longest standing sponsor of the Olympic Games, 1928 is when they started, longest standing continuous sponsor. So 1928, so they're coming up on 100 years of continuous sponsorship at the top level, or the Olympic partners, what TOP stands for. And so they realized that a lot of the attributes of their brand were the same as the attributes of the Olympics, you know, bringing the world together, sharing experiences, authenticity, things like this. And so for them, it just made so much sense. And in 1988, they became the official pin trading sponsor, and they could create the official pin trading center. And that was the Games in Calgary. So another Canadian city, for that matter. And so what we would do is we would say, okay, what are the different ways that we can engage with our fans, with our enthusiasts, with our consumers? And so we looked across all of the different opportunities, and we said, okay, let's create pins that represent the pictogram. So these are all the different images of all the different sports. Let's create. And so all of them had our co-branded logo, right? So this was something that was created for the games themselves, Coca-Cola and the Olympic. Not the five rings. The five rings were there, but the actual event itself. So let's just say in the case of the Vancouver Games.
So biathlon or something like that.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And it would be Coca-Cola and the Vancouver Olympic logo created a single logo. So they brought the two logos together, create a composite logo. So every one of these would have those pictograms of the biathlon. There would be ones for all of the flags representing all of the countries that were participating. So you can see how many different stock keeping units we have. Then there were pins associated with all of maybe the venues. And so there could be another 15 there. And then there might be pins associated with all of things that are naturally Coca-Cola. So vending machines and Coca-Cola trucks and things like that. And then there was that 17 days of the Olympic Games. So there was a 17-day pin set that formed the Coca-Cola bottle. And as you can see, you create all of these different pin sets. And you're really looking for opportunities for people to buy pins and then trade them to create an experience. And the pin was there to help memorialize that experience. So when you held the pin up, you could say, yeah, I remember when I was there, I met this incredibly funny lady from Switzerland, and she had this unique pin from back when, from the Innsbruck Games, and I had this pin from Nagano, and I traded my pin with her. And so you have this incredible experience, and it's all because Coca-Cola was there creating that pin for you to be able to have that exchange. And it was magical. I mean, it was really magical what happened, and it's something I'm so glad I got to be part of.
Hi, everyone. Do you want to be your best customer's vendor of choice? Do you want to cement relationships with them, add real value, and gain insights that your competitors just can't get? Go to podcasthostforhire.com. That's podcasthostforhire.com. And let's work together to make you the value vendor of choice. So let's talk about it from a logistic point of view, because it's not Coca-Cola making the pins.
Correct.
There is an official pin supplier for the Olympics. And they're not just making Coca-Cola's pins. They're making Visa's pins. They're making the Olympic pins. They're making pins for the different organizations. It's not just your 800 pins. They're probably making 1,000 or 2,000 or 5,000 different pins. And we're not talking 10 pins of each. We're talking tens of thousands of pins of each particular one. And this is just one promotional item. I mean, there's hats, there's mugs, there's t-shirts, there's lunch bags, there's a million different things that you're doing with. First of all, curate what vendor programs you're going to be part of, what vendor programs you're not going to be part of, and decide, because I'm assuming this is almost 250 days just for production schedule, let alone design and contract building and licensing agreements and everything that go along with that. So where do you start when you're having those conversations?
So great question. And just for clarity's sake, there is a, you know, just for the audience, there's two important components here. There's all the promotional merchandise that's bought by the sponsors to give to their guests, their customers, all of those, right? And then that's a big program that Coca-Cola had and every other sponsor had. But then we had what I was working on, which were these licensed pins.
Those are the ones people pay for.
Exactly. And so they were separate and distinct. But usually what happened was senior executives came to us and said, I want a special pin out of that licensing set for my own go-to pin, right? So you were alluding to that earlier, and that was important for us to take into consideration. And the pin sets, right? The pin of the day set, they may buy 150 of those to give to our best customers. So those were sales that we were selling internally from my department to, you know, another executive department. But it was all good. And that was part of my, you know, kind of my charge to get that done. But what we would do is the first thing is the sponsorship agreement said that we were officially allowed to create licensed merchandise and to be the pin official pin trading center. Once we had that, then we went to the licensing group within the Olympic committee and said, okay, we want to create a co-branded Olympic program. We will work with you in concert to create these products. And so in the case of Vancouver, for example, not only do we have pins, we had plush, we had cups or mugs, we had lanyards. I'm trying to think what else we had. We had like seven different categories of merchandise. Pins were being important. Of course, all the apparel too, right? So t-shirts and even some vests and things like that and caps and hats. And so we had to, once we had that program agreement with the Olympic Committee, then we had permission to go into the categories that we agreed were going to be those co-branded categories and then go find licensees. Now, the first place we had to look because of the arrangements that are already made and the commitments made by these licensees to the Olympic Committee was to look to them first. They were already official and we wanted to work with them if we could. And where we couldn't, like they were not interested in this co-branded program or they couldn't meet our price points or our timelines, then we were authorized to go outside. And so in the case of Vancouver Games, for example, the company that we worked with was Aminco, they were already officially sanctioned. And so it was easy to work with them. But my gosh, for them, they had all the pressure on them to get all this done. Now, fortunately, we'd been working with them for several Olympic Games, so they weren't starting from scratch. They kind of knew what we needed, and they knew all the different categories. And we gave them the style guide, and we told them what we were trying to do. And then we quickly signed them as a co-branded licensee. And then we went off to the races and said, okay, you know, this is a year out, maybe 9 or 10 months out. Okay, here's the categories. Start to get back to us as quickly as you can with all of these two-dimensional designs of these pins. You know how it works. And for the most part, they did perfectly. You know, we weren't asking them to make any changes of any kind because they had already done this for several games. And so then it was just a question of getting those approved, getting the prototypes approved, getting those pins tested, you know, because we don't want any lead-based paint in these pins and things like that. And once that was all done, then going, okay, you've got to figure out with our official retailer how many pins you're going to sell there and how many pins you're going to sell to the other brick and mortar retailers.
So they are Amico, who's your pin partner. They're responsible for the sell through.
They are. That was the beauty of it. You know, this was the big difference between the Atlanta Games and the starting with the Nagano Games and going forward. When I worked for the Atlanta Games, I didn't work in licensing. I was with this group, this business affairs and the sponsorship group. And I worked on Coca-Cola Olympic City. And so I saw a little bit what was going on, but Coca-Cola for those games was asked by ACOG, the Atlanta Olympic Group, to be a licensee, which was weird because we didn't make the pins. We didn't make any of that stuff. So we had to contract with these manufacturers and then pay a royalty to the Olympic Committee as if we were the ones that were the licensee. So, and then we got left with whatever inventory was left. We were left holding the bag for it. And so we extricated ourselves from that process and said, you guys are much smarter about this than we are. We will be the co-licensor along with the Olympic Committee, and you will have to figure out, along with your retailer, how many pins or other merchandise to manufacture. And then once you sell all that, we'll co-share a royalty that is a percentage of the sales for the sales that you make. So it was much more effective and truthfully the right way to do it.
So does this make it almost near impossible for a new vendor to break into being a licensee based on the fact that they don't know what they don't know? Because, you know, as you said, when the Olympics are done, they're done. And you could be stuck with 10,000, 100,000, a million pieces if you guess wrong. And it could bankrupt so many companies. As Coca-Cola, do you guys have an advisory or do you guys have a set of parameters that you say, listen, this is how we work with our licensees to be able to say, listen, this was the run rate we've had for the last three Olympics to give you some ideas, or are you basically leaving it to the licensees to basically figure it out on their own?
Yeah, definitely not leaving it to them, but it is an interesting balance between the two. Fortunately, the good thing for this kind of event where we were coming in as a sponsor and getting permission to create an official merchandise program that was co-branded, we could go to the organizing committee and we could say to them, and by the way, we want to support you, organizing committee, who are the licensees you have today? So at least we knew that they already had been vetted by the organizing committee. They already knew how to create merchandise because they were creating single branded merchandise for the organizing committee and probably had been doing that for several years. And now they were going to be asked to participate in a program where we would be involved. Of course, they love the Coke name. So usually there was a decent amount of interest. Then it was a question of, could they make it happen? And some couldn't, so they just didn't sign up. Others wanted to try, and they did, and they had those risks. But, you know, they'd seen what was going on. They also knew what we were going to do. You know, and the topic of this conversation, the holistic topic was Olympic activation, right? So
yeah,
we would tell them what we were going to do for the Olympic Games, how we were going to activate, right? So what are all the consumer activities that we're going to do for the Games? What kind of advertising campaign are we going to have for the Games? Where are we going to have presence in the greater city that's being hosted, and to use and be able to leverage all of that to shed light on these programs so that their merchandise wasn't just showing up on some shelf with nobody knowing about it. So that definitely helped them. But at the end of the day, it was still a risk for them, and some did better than others. I remember after the Vancouver Games, I remember talking to my apparel licensee, and he said, you know, I'm really happy with what we did, but if you had told me a year earlier, I could have done a nationwide program and done 10 times as much. And I said, I know. I wished I had been able to tell you a year earlier. I was not told a year earlier. So consequently, you didn't get told. But that's the difference in the magnitude of what could have been had we been able to get out in front of this earlier on, just to give these licensees the chance to do something significant. And a lot of it had to do with not just their ability to execute, but it had to do with the ability for the retailer to buy, because that retailer had already committed their shelves to other products. So they didn't have the capacity even to buy our product if they loved it, because they knew they were going to stock their shelves with something else.
They had already committed to something else. And that's the challenge. I mean, I remember Vancouver. I mean, Vancouver had official Olympic store. I'm sure there was a lot of Olympic places to buy Olympic merch throughout the Olympics. But I remember the official Olympic store was in the floor of the Hudson's Bay. And this has got to be 100, 150,000 square feet, somewhere in that neighborhood. I have no idea how big the floor is, but it's huge.
Yeah.
And it was just wall to wall merchandise. And you could sit, you had everything in there, from plush to pins to coffee mugs to shirts to towels, to everything. And you sit there and say, the dance has got to be incredible. How much floor space do I take? Do I take too much? Do I take not enough? And be able to sit there and look at these activations and say, 2 years before, and say, what's going to sell and what's not going to sell for 37 days. And okay, you might get, you know, 60 days ahead of that, and you might get 15 days after that. But really, that's your buying window.
It's really tight. And yeah, you're right. There's 17 days of the Olympics. You got a little bit of a lead up time, and then you got the Paralympics after that. And then it's a steep drop off, right? Just a little bit that might be going on. In the case of most of the games, I can tell you, for example, with Nagano, for us as an example, we saw sales quadruple from the day before the Olympic Games to the day of the Games. And then they went up maybe double in the next week and stayed there till the very end. And then they dropped off like 90% very quickly during the Paralympic Games. And then by the time the Paralympic Games were over, it was almost zero. So it was just kind of just there and gone in a blip.
And you're going to have different merch for the Paralympics Games than you are for the Olympic Games
themselves.
Yeah,
there's a different logo, right? So different design. And so, you know, who wants to take a risk on that? So in many instances, we didn't, or our licensees didn't. We were literally selling the same co-branded Olympic merchandise during the Paralympic Games. And that's unfortunate for the Paralympians, but it was just too much inventory risk. And you couldn't blame the licensees for that.
Yeah. What was the biggest challenge for doing an Olympic size activation? What was the one thing that, because you've done a lot of these Olympics, you've done what, five of them or something like that?
It was five where I've done, you know, the official licensed merchandise. In a couple instances, I did more than that, but yeah, five games for that. That would have been starting with Nagano and then Salt Lake. And then I got involved heavily, not so much in licensed merchandise, but on the Olympic torch relay for the Athens Games. That was kind of a unique, special opportunity because it was a global Olympic torch relay. And then Vancouver and Sochi. So those were, I actually was there leading up to and through the Olympic Games.
So of all the Olympic Games that you were part of, what was the biggest challenge that you can talk about? Because I'm sure there's things that you just can't talk about. I've heard stories about Sochi that just make your head go explode, but that's a different story altogether.
Yeah. I like to say there was, in the case of Sochi, but it was truthfully in all of them, maybe Sochi more than others, our program was on cardiac arrest more than two times just because of so many challenges. So in the case of like Sochi, for example, we got started even a little bit later. There was an official retailer that was going to have our Olympic Pin Trading Center in their store. Think about like the Hudson's Bay and how we were in that store, right? But literally, that retailer was supposed to place an order with our official licensee. And when that order did not come, the official licensee told me about 6 months out, if we don't get this order in the next week, we are out of this program. We are gone. And I knew if I lost them, there was no way I was going to have a program because they were the only ones that could pull it off.
Yeah.
There was no opportunity to switch to some Russian company. That was never going to work. So I basically told them by, you know, over my dead body, are you going to be out? We'll find a way to get you that purchase order. So they agreed to stay on. And literally like 2 months later, this official retailer said to us, we're out. Not only had they not placed the order, but they were out. And literally, we were 2 months from the games and we were scrambling. And thankfully, the company that created the official Olympic medals was also a jeweler. And that jeweler said, hey, we want the exposure of Coca-Cola Olympic, Sochi Olympic merchandise. We will step in, we'll create the pin trading retail center, and we will buy the inventory. And they saved the games. And so there's two examples of literally where we were in cardiac arrest and didn't know whether we could resuscitate the patient. But as I told my client at the time, I said, Gabriella, we got to picture ourselves in the pin trading center looking and celebrating this amazing day. And I told her this like 4 months out. And, you know, there we were, you know, February 12th or whatever the date was, sitting in the center. I said, here we are, just like we pictured. And she was like, which was one of the greatest compliments ever. She said, Pete, I believe because you believed. And thankfully, we made it happen. And it was pretty special.
And people don't seem to understand 120 days. That's nothing in terms of production.
It's a blink of an eye.
That's a blink of an eye. I mean, you blink and you're gone. And even losing a weekend at that point in time could be the difference between making the production and not making the production. And God help you if you get caught with Chinese New Year.
Oh, yeah. And that was stuff was going on too, right? Because that was all factored in because the manufacturing facilities were in China. So we had to factor that all into it. And literally for those games, if I recall correctly, we had probably like days 1 through 4 in a shipment that came right before the game started. We had days 5 through 8 in a shipment that came like a week into the Olympic Games. And it literally was like that piecemeal coming in. And I'm just saying, dear Lord, let them get done. Let them get approved. Let them pass through customs and let them get to us transportation and on the shelf. Because especially when you're talking about a pin of the day set, you cannot afford not to have pin day 12 or 14 or 16. You know, that's all part of the set. And if you don't have them all, you don't have a set. And that was kind of our key promotional item, right? We unveiled that pin every day at like 11 a.m. And I just couldn't imagine how embarrassing it would be if we said, well, the pins did not arrive. And so there's no pin of the day set today. So yeah, it was insanely crazy. And as you say, one weekend could make the difference between doing it or not doing it.
And you need to multiply this out by 15 different vendors.
Yeah, right.
It's not just one, you know, it's not just the pins. It's a whole logistics train and it's figuring out shipping and boxes and customs and all the things that we've talked about and being able to realize that we're not just talking about 50 pieces. We're talking about 50,000.
Yeah.
And when you're looking at stuff that level, the problems just become that much more insurmountable.
I wrote a book that published in 2018 called Expand, Grow, Thrive. And in chapter one, this was my story with the Nagano Olympic Games. And you know, I get into detail about it. And for those who are interested, it's a crazy story. And it starts with me literally answering a call on the last day of the games. I was back in Atlanta from my manager in Nagano, Japan. And he said, don't worry, but the police called me last night. And I was like, what? And I won't tell any more of the story, but to say that it was crazy and chaotic what went down. And you're right. I mean, we had to have all of those SKUs from all those different vendors. And of course, all of the back of part of it is the approvals and the process. But we also had business objectives. We needed them to create and sell merchandise. We had to hit certain numbers of different product. We had to hit certain revenue targets. We had to hit certain royalty revenue targets. And so for us, it was brand building, but it was also royalty revenue that we had to deliver. So it was way more than just having excellent merchandise in people's hands.
I love it. There's so much more we could talk about. I want to make sure we're going to get a way for people to get in touch with you, both through Brand Alive. I also want to make sure that your book, you know, we have a way that people could get to your book because that's going to be a phenomenal read. I got to grab a copy of this thing and have a read. But before I let you go, I'm going to ask you one question. It's because a question I ask everybody as they walk out the door. When you leave a meeting and you get in your car and you drive away, what's the one thing you want people to think about you when you're not in the room?
It's a wonderful question. And for me, the question is about the kind of character I am, the kind of person I am. I want them, they may never choose to work with me, but I want them to know that if they were to choose to work with me, they could be completely confident, A, that I would always bring my best, that I would always act with transparency and integrity, and that I had the ability to do what I said I was going to be able to do. And if that was what I could leave behind, I knew that everything else would take care of itself.
Pete, you know what? Living a life of integrity is the only way to live it. You, like me, we have a little bit of gray hair on the side of our heads, but you know what? It's well earned, and the stories that came with it make it worth all the while. So thanks for being such an amazing guest.
Gosh, it's been so much pleasure, Ben. This has been a lot of fun reminiscing about those crazy days. And, you know, as I was telling you off camera earlier, if we didn't ever have any challenges, we would never have anything to talk about. So I'm glad for the challenges. I'm glad for the experiences. And hopefully some of them were interesting to your audience today.
Absolutely.
This has been the YourLivingBrand.live show. I want to thank you for tuning in today. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to the show at YourLivingBrand.live and share your favorite episodes with colleagues and friends. At Your Brand Marketing, we help companies engage, retain, and grow their most valuable assets, their employees. If you're tired of losing great staff and want to retain your best employees, build brand champions and leaders at any level. Contact us for a 30-minute consultation at YourBrandMarketing.com. That's www.YourBrandMarketing.com. Thank you again for listening and sharing. Tune in next week when we ask another guest, what's your story?